Accession number 17268, Reel 3.
On the way to the summit, we did destroy several anti-tank guns, but there again, we lost one or two tanks on mines. And the engineers had to come along and clear a path for us and tape it. It was a long, hard day. As we were on the start line at 5:30 that morning, and by the time we had got to the top of the ridge, daylight was falling. It had been a long, hard day, and we were all very, very tired. I am pleased to say that amongst the awards and decorations awarded to the regiment for this battle, my own commander, Roy Bryan, did receive the DCM. After the next operation, which was to capture a town called San Vito, only about 10 miles from north of the ridge we'd occupied recently, from there on, there was a battle, but which only lasted about 2 days. After that, we were told to retire, withdrawn after several weeks of being more or less constantly in action or on the alert. We were to be relieved by a Canadian armoured regiment. And here, I was a little bit disappointed in our Canadian friends. Having been occupied in various ways for about 3 weeks, very little had come, especially over the rivers, the Sangro, in the way of supplies, particularly cigarettes. So by the time we were at San Vito, all the crew were completely out of cigarettes. And although we studied for hours and hours because we were possibly occupied, by the time we were free, I'm afraid we had to scour the floor of the turret and the driving compartment for the stub ends and make about 2 cigarettes or 3 cigarettes into one using toilet paper. And there it was a case of light one up, pass it around, all around the crew, until there. But when we did pull out, to be relieved by the Canadian Armoured Regiment, we stopped and asked them if they could give us some cigarettes. And I'm afraid the answer was no, but they would sell us some Victory V cigarettes, which, as many old soldiers would know, or particularly desert soldiers, always thought they were made from camel dung. They were literally horrible cigarettes. Of course, they were a very, very cheap issue. I think they were made in Egypt. But the Canadians, friends in armour, they wanted to charge us 10 shillings for a packet of 20 cigarettes. And we didn't think much of them, particularly as they were Victory V's. Very disappointed. We bought some, of course, because we were really hard up for a smoke. The weather at that time, mid-December, was very, very wet, and conditions such that they were totally unsuitable for much in the way of armoured breakthroughs. Our job mainly was odd support of infantry attacks, mainly by composite squadrons, or even, as we were later, a few days before Christmas, 4 tanks, a composite troop, were sent off to a particular village just south of Pescara, the road from Pescara, mainly into a holding position, while the regiment generally were at Cerro Capriola and celebrated Christmas and New Year there. Our troop of four were in this small farmhouse halfway up a mountain, so it seemed, and the farmer, and just a farmer and his wife and one son. Unfortunately, the farmer was very annoyed when, as troops normally do, investigate and search farms, when some of the lads, they found a cupboard somewhere hidden, and behind which was the farmer's very best masala. And boy, was it good masala. In fact, when he found that our lads had discovered it, he almost cried. That was the day before Christmas. Came Christmas Day, and we had, of course, the normal bully beef or compo rations from out of the tank. But fortunately, our spirit rations had managed to get through. So by the time we had fed the farmer with a few whiskies or gins, he was very, very happy and more or less opened his cupboard to us. Unfortunately, that night, Jerry decided to send a stunk over at the time when the MO and the Padre just arrived in a jeep. And of course things were really noisy, and the MO came in and said, well, what a bloody welcome on Christmas. Other than a few odd artillery stunks, nothing happened, not even over the new year. Only the most exciting news of all was very early in January, the news came through that we were going home, back to England, to be prepared for what was to be the forthcoming invasion of Europe. This news was very well received, of course. On January the 11th, we handed our tanks over to the 50th Royal Tank Regiment, and then made our way eventually down to a railway somewhere, but we boarded the usual trucks of 40 men or 8 horses, and eventually wended its way very, very slowly by a circuitous route round to Naples. On reaching the quayside at Naples, we were dismissed on the understanding that we had to be back by a certain time. If not, if you were late back on parade, you missed the boat home. As we had acquired somehow another a fair number of lira, but it had to be a fair number, millions I expect, of certainly thousands, nothing in the shops. The only thing we could do was spend it on, well, a few celebratory drinks. And I think the popular thing at that particular time was cherry brandy. Now, quite a few liras were spent on cherry brandy. So by the time everyone was back on parade to go aboard the boat, everyone was a very, very happy mood. Conditions on the boat coming home were far better than those going out to Egypt in the first place. There again, our mood was very much better because we were coming home. I think it took about 2 weeks to from leaving Naples until we pulled into the Clyde at Gorak, and there I can remember one of our troop, Archie Smart, saying, "That's where I live, just over there." He could see the actual house where he lived from where we were anchored in the Clyde. After disembarking at the railway station, I was enabled to cajole a porter to telephone my sister to say, "I am back in the country." This is absolute contrary, of course, to regulations at the time. We're not supposed to say we were back. But that message did get through, eventually, through to my wife. The train took us down to Worthing, where after a few days of getting out of leave passes, money, and ration cards, etc., we were home on leave, sent home on leave. And I came back to Birmingham with a fellow also from Birmingham who, even in the desert, would say, when it was very hot, "Oh, I would love a pint of Ansell's," which was one of the local brewery. And I frequently told him, "Well, when we get back into Birmingham, sketch, I will buy you one." And that was a promise. When we arrived back into Birmingham, straight out of the railway station and into the nearest pub, which I knew, the Traveller's Rest. And it was a rest. We called for, naturally, two pints. But the landlord refused payment. I think it was mainly because we were wearing the African Star ribbon, had only just been recently issued, and of course the colouring of our faces was like mahogany. We had our first two pints, as promised, but I tried to buy Sketch, the pint, as promised, and unfortunately someone else paid. Someone who obviously guess we were soldiers back home. And after another pint, also paid by somebody else from another party, I said to my friend, "Well, I'm going home to the wife, who I haven't seen for now a couple of years. No more. I will see you during our 28 days leave." So from there I caught the bus, of course blackout as it was, back to the area in which I lived. And in going up the lane to home, walking towards me were two people who shone a torch under the ground so as I could avoid walking into them. And having passed them a yard or two, they called out, "Is that you, Mr. England?" And I recognised the name, the voice of a neighbour. And after hellos and shaking hands and so on, "Glad to you're home again," the gentleman said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going home." He said, "But you don't live there anymore," which of course was quite a shock. But realising that our mail from England had been stopped at the end of November, I'd had no news from my wife at all from beginning of December, and then it was end of January. So she'd apparently made this move without telling me. But so they said, "Well, you don't live far away, we will take you there." my wife having moved that very, very day to a new house. And having had my message through my sister that I was back in England, it was a case of all hands on deck. Both neighbours and relatives had helped my wife move and get all the furniture, curtains and everything, carpeting, all organised. And they just about finished. I think it was about 8:30, 9 o'clock at night when I had arrived home, and my wife came to the door, of course, all dirty without, say, from where I moved. But anyway, it was really lovely to see her. 28 days leave, then down to Worthing to be re-equipped, reorganised, and all teed up, ready for what was to be the second front. We, of course, got new tanks, again, all Sherman, but whereas in Italy our tanks had twin-engined GMCs and steel tracks, those we were issued to at Worthing were fitted with the Wright Whirlwind engine and rubber tracks, which were later to prove not very satisfactory, especially on mud. The months of April and up to the middle of May were spent mainly in the fitting of the exhaust chute and the general waterproofing of all the sails underneath, escape hatches and so on, and of course testing and driving into a pit and coming out again on test. By the end of May, my wife and little daughter had to leave the area, as did all the visitors. It was obvious then at that particular time that things were likely to move any moment. In fact, by about June the 1st, we were on the move, and a friend that my wife had made in Worthing did send my wife a postcard to say that her cold had gone. In other words, I was the cold. That was the code arranged between them. We moved from Worthing down to Leon Solent and stayed there ready for the big day, which was soon, very soon to come. We boarded the LSTs on the 5th of June in very, very miserable weather, not looking forward to any crossing of the channel. We stayed on board, and it was not until sometime during the next morning that we heard that the invasion had actually started. Our own journey across the channel started early afternoon, but of course it was only about a 4-knot convoy, so it took us many, many hours to cross the channel. I don't know what time we arrived off the beaches. In fact, everything was hazy. There was so much going on here, there, noise of the warships, guns banging away, and general commotion. We had a fairly good landing, and I don't think went into water any more than 3 feet deep, so I was able to pull up over the fairly hard sand and away, so the parts that had been cleared and taped by the engineers. I seem to remember that we pulled inland, no more than half a mile, and off into some fields until all the regiment, or the majority of the regiment, had landed, and we were all sorted out into our various squadrons. And of course the majors, the squadron leaders, they all had to go off to brigade headquarters to find out what the lay of the land was and the up-to-date situation.